How you been? I'm sorry for being. This is probably one of the most derelict episodes I've had.
Good. I know how it goes. I've had holiday stuff. It's hard to get anything done right around now.
But thank you for being gracious and flexible about this.
Sure, of course.
So the wanted to recount. I just felt that the. As I was telling you at the party when we met, that my initial reaction was that your documentary, 20 Feet from Stardom, sounded initially like something that was not necessarily vital to see. And I kind of like said, well, I don't know, you know. And I, because I felt is probably, you know, nothing to do with craft. I just felt that subject was probably not the thing. And then I happened to go to a screening at the former Racquet Club in Park City. I mean,
Oh,
I
yeah.
Nancy was very gracious. Nancy Will was very gracious about it. She didn't push it on me. I wish she had pushed it on me. I wish she said, "Listen, Jeff, your instincts are wrong here. You got to catch this one." So anyway, I owe the my going to 20 Feet from Stardom to Ryan Werner, formerly of IFC Films, and now
Yeah.
a PR consultant. He's the one that told me that he thinks it's pretty good. I think you better catch it. So I said, "Okay, I'll go." And I was like blown away when I went there. And it was. Not just one of the best films I had seen during that whole festival. It was like the first one. It was like I think it was the second thing I saw, and it was like, wow, this is a grand slam. And
Wow. Well, thank you. It's funny, Ryan. He was at IFC at the time, and they were one of the companies that was bidding for the film. And I met him opening night, and he was great. And I knew about him. I'd never met him before that night.
Now,
And then,
they were
yeah.
bidding as we spoke, you're saying? In other words, you had had screenings for buyers prior to Sundance?
Well, we were the opening night film, so that Thursday night, I can't remember what night. Because the racquetball club is which one, which theater
Well,
do they call
it
that?
used to be called the Racquet Club. Now it's called the something. It's the one that's sort of behind the Eccles, about maybe a quarter of a mile or something. It's that it used to be called the Racquet Club, and now it's called something else. But it's basically a racquet club.
Yeah. Oh, I know that one. Okay, so that was the Friday night.
That's where I happened
Okay.
to. That's not where it screened. I saw it at the Yarrow, but he's the one. I saw him at the Racquet Club, and I
Oh,
told him,
yeah.
you know.
So, because we screened it opening night at the Eccles, which was amazing. You
Oh,
know,
okay.
all the women were there, and none of them had seen the film, and you know, I'd never shown it to an audience, and it was incredible. But then, you know, I was saying this to cut to 6 months later, and Ryan's actually been working on our movie now, which is awesome,
Okay.
because he's been doing freelance stuff for Radius, and Ryan's great, so I got to work with Ryan after all. But I love hearing stories like that because, you know, and I've heard that from a number of people who are like, backup singers, do I care? You know, and I take that as like a challenge, you know, to make a film that feels more urgent than it would seem on its surface.
It's urgent, and it's vital because we all feel that we have. It's all basically, you know, your gifts are better and more valuable, more profound than perhaps the world has recognized. And a lot of people feel that way about some, you know, maybe fully expressed but not fully rewarded gift that they have. I think
Yeah.
that's a pretty broad metaphor for a lot of people.
It is. I mean, that was something we discovered on the way. I mean, the nice thing about making the film was that, you know, I had a producer who was willing to back me and to kind of let me find the story. And I had no agenda going into it other than to just observe these singers in this world and kind of reflect back what I thought was interesting about it. And you know, for a long time in the beginning when I was interviewing these singers, you know, I remember feeling like this could be a really depressing documentary. Because there were so many sad stories. But the thing that struck me as so unusual was how there was a lack of bitterness, and there's a real kind of spirit and upbeatness to these singers that, you know, I had to think about, like, how is it that these people obviously are more talented than the people they're singing behind, obviously had the voices, you know, better than, you know, should have had every opportunity a lot of other singers had. And, you know, why is it that they've been able to make peace mm-hmm. with it? Mm-hmm. You know, and that became kind of the deeper exploration that I ended up following. I mean, it was purely coming from them, you know.
You know,
they taught me a lot.
Yeah. So I was wondering, I actually, when you get right down to it, although I've got the screener, I don't think I haven't seen it since last January. Did you change it at all? Did you refine? Nothing. Okay.
It has not changed at all since Sundance.
Okay. Is there now the Blu-ray is coming out in mid-January, I believe.
Yeah, a couple weeks.
And are there any extras or anything that
There is. I mean, there are a lot of extras. I'm trying to remember, you know, at least half an hour worth of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were some scenes. There were, I think on there, mm-hmm. there's a scene with Judith's parents that I always loved, you know, and her mm-hmm. mom's the classically trained Japanese pianist and her dad's a black funk bass player. And Judith is totally the amalgam of those two things. And her parents have this jam session together, and I always loved the scene, but by the time Judas gets introduced in the movie, it's just too late to have a scene like that, and so I stuck it there. And the other thing, you know, there were several other characters I spent a lot of time with who ended up getting cut out or cut down.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know, there's somebody like, there's this young, beautiful Australian singer named Jo Lowry who pops up a couple times, and she's kind of in the finale, and I'd filmed a lot with her, and she had a great story, and so I filmed, you know, I included some of that on the DVD, and you know, I interviewed probably 75 backup singers total, you know, only 50 of whom didn't make the cut, which was very hard, so I have kind of like a long, just kind of sequence of a lot of the singers who didn't make the film talking, and, you know, exploring some of these themes deeper. And then I think we have a round table with Mary and Darlene and Lisa and I.
Oh, that's cool.
And,
a little extra, is it part of the, making of, or what is that? How is
it actually? It actually was the, we did a Times Talks with John Perelis.
Oh, okay.
So they let us put that on the DVD, too, because mm-hmm. it was one of the few times we actually had a real Q&A with all of us together.
Has the, you know what I love what you did when you had your, there was a portion of the film, obviously, about the wonderful Mary Clayton, who a lot of people who knew the Stones know her primarily, for those who haven't seen it, as the one who did that electrifying bridge solo during their song Give Me Shelter. And you got hold of the isolated vocal track, which was that tricky at all, or is that, how did you manage that? Because I thought it was really cool to listen to it isolated.
Yeah, I mean, I actually found it on the internet.
I love it. you can go. How do you do that? You go to. You can find commonly single, just vocal track, or just instrumental tracks of various pop songs.
I mean, what I heard is somebody had bootlegged it several years ago when they had done Rock Band.
Okay.
Because the ISO tracks got out, and they kept shutting them down, and somebody posted it briefly mm-hmm. on YouTube. And I downloaded it before they took it down, and I got it. And so that's what I played for them. You know, Mary had never heard it, and Nick had never heard it. And but just hearing that is a total revelation to me. And it, you know, and then when I didn't know how it was all. I didn't even know there was a story behind the song. I just wanted to play it for Mary. So she tells me this whole story about the curlers and in the middle of the night, and then I played her the track, and it was just, you know, I got goosebumps in the room, and I remember thinking, that's amazing. And then the next thought I had was, oh my God, I have to clear this song. Which is not easy.
Yeah, who did you have to go to? I mean, I presume Rolling Stones have their own brand, and they were
no,
part
they
of
don't.
It, right? No,
they don't. ABCO controls all of it.
Okay.
Alan Klein.
Okay.
Who passed? The guy who managed the
Did Eagles, he not pass?
Away.
Yeah, right.
He passed away a few years ago, but his kids run the company. And,
right.
And I had actually worked with them some, and with Mick, because I produced the Crossfire Hurricane documentary for HBO.
That was a good doc also. That was really good. That was the one that was directed by...
By Brett.
Brett,
Morgan.
Yeah. Which was also at Sundance. Right?
He was on the jury at Sundance.
No,
but
I remember...
Wasn't there.
Oh, Crossfire was not there. Was there something else that he did? Wait a minute, now I'm getting confused. I thought that he... I could have sworn
no.
I met him at Sundance.
He was on the jury last year at Sundance.
Okay. All right, we'll let it go for that. Anyway.
Yeah. So. I'm going to be on the jury this year. So
oh, good for you.
I'm excited. Mary
mm-hmm.
was somebody else who just has a million stories, and it's been great mm-hmm. to be with them because I've gone to all these film festivals with them and hung out with them. And Mary's this person who, mm-hmm. every time you're with her, you learn about some other amazing song she sang on. Or if you're sitting in a restaurant, she'll say, oh, that's me singing.
Mm.
And she's done it over and over. And I remember we were in a restaurant and Someday We'll Be Together came on.
Mm.
And she's like, oh, that's me. And I said, but that's Diana Ross and the Supremes. She's like, no, it's not Supremes. It's me. She's like, I'm singing Second Soprano. Gloria Jones is on top. Annetta Field, Shirley Matthews, you know, and she sang her part. I was like, okay, I believe you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And just things like that, you know, constantly are constant surprises.
Now, again, for those who have not seen it, there's a kind of a, the arc, one of the things that really sticks in your mind when you've, after watching it is the story of the singer who is, I think we're talking about Darlene, who had more or less gotten out of singing and taken up house cleaning for a while as a way to just sort of make ends meet. Am I missing that? Or is that not Darlene?
That's somebody else? That's Darlene.
Okay. And you that know, and that period that when she was doing house cleaning was what, in the 90s? When was that?
No, that was around 1981.
Okay. Now, the one thing that you talk about the depressing aspects of the doc, well, there is one depressing thing for sure, and that is that the whole interest in and using of backup singers, which can be wonderful in so many different ways, it just doesn't seem to be happening as much with the recording technologies, or maybe just tastes, or just the you know, there's not enough. I hope and presume that there's lots of activity for these guys to keep doing for the rest of their lives and concerts and whatnot. But it just seems like it's not happening as much on records.
It's not at all. I mean, there are many different reasons for that. I mean, part of it is the implosion of the music industry has meant that the days of having big studio sessions
mm-hmm.
where you could actually bring in really good singers mm-hmm. And have them do their thing, those are virtually extinct at this point. And so backup singers have to make their living like most musicians do these days, which is touring.
Right.
You know, and that's a very difficult life. And, you know, that's where backup singing does exist, is there. You know, and there are people like, you know, I interviewed a guy for the documentary, and I ended up not putting him in, but a guy named Paul Epworth, who, you know, he won Producer of the Year last year at the Grammys. And so he produced Adele and Florence and the Machine. And he said, you know, Adele will send him a hard drive with 57 backup vocal parts, and he'll just... you know, fiddle with them and put it together, and that's, she's her own backup singer. And so it's Florence. The funny thing is, on Adele 21, he produced half the album, and on all of those tracks, it's Adele doing her own backup vocals. On the other half, Rick Rubin produced it, and he brought the Waters in to sing live backups.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear the difference. I mean, there's just something organic in real people standing around a microphone coming up with a blend and they all talk about the blend, you know, not only being this kind of spiritual journey, but the blend itself is more than the sum of its parts. And in fact, it creates a new voice that is more than the parts of the individual voices. I mean, that's something you just don't get out of one person overdubbing their voice and putting it through auto-tune and everything else. Just as a lover of brilliant musicians and just being in the presence of that, which I was over and over making the film. I mean, being in a room and hearing people sing like that is amazing. I mean, it's just, you know, gives you chills and you feel you know, it's the real thing happening. And I wish that happened more today, but we don't put a lot of value on it, unfortunately.
You know what? I just found the Brett Morgan Sundance link. Chicago 10. That will be 6 years, actually 7 years ago as of this coming Sundance. Chicago 10. I happened to meet him very early in the 2007 festival. He was there early and I was there early. Nobody was there. Have you ever been there just before it starts, before anybody gets there? It's bizarre.
No, I haven't, actually. I haven't. You know, I always, because I know other people, a friend of mine who goes every year, goes in a day early, and she loves it.
What's the routine, by the way, for jurors? You guys all stay in the same hotel? You have a do you all see the same film en masse, and then kind of meet every day and sort of kick things around? How does it work?
Well, I'm just learning it now, and they haven't actually made the official juror announcement until just after New Year's. FYI. I mean, what I understand about it is that we all stay in the same hotel. They try and get you to see the premieres of the films as much as you can, but you can't catch all of them. And different people have different, you know, things in their schedule. So, you know, I know I'm doing a panel one day and I have to go to another thing another day. So I'm missing two films then, but I'll catch up with them later in the week.
And you're focusing, I presume, they've got you focusing strictly on the documentaries, right?
Yes, on U.S. doc competition, which is 16 films.
And there's also a foreign doc competition, correct?
There's a foreign doc competition. I think there are only three jurors for that.
Okay.
And there are a bunch of premieres I really want to see. So I've been looking at the schedule, trying to figure out how I can wedge more films into my week.
You mean documentaries appearing within the premiere section, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, I want to see a bunch of those. I know Amir, who did the Penn State doc that I've been hearing great things about, and Greg Barker's Revolution doc. I know Greg, and I really wanted to see that, and I've heard good things about it.
What is it you have heard about the Penn State particularly? Is this the one about the scandal that happened at Penn State?
Yeah,
okay,
it is.
What is the title of that again?
It has a weird title. What is it? Something Valley or?
Okay.
I have to Google it to remember. It's Amir.
It is Amir Barlev, who I just saw at the DGA for the screening of his documentary about the Hurricane Sandy.
The 12/12/12.
12/12/12, which was very good, very good. It was good to see him.
Haven't seen it actually.
Mm-hmm.
I got invited that night. One, they had one here in LA, and I couldn't go to it. But I heard it was a great party. And my producer, in fact, on 20 Feet from Stardom, was his producer on Tillman's Story. So,
okay, right. That was a really superb film, Tillman's Story.
Yeah, that was. So John Batzik produced this new one with Amir, the Penn State one. And I know John, and John always does great work as a producer. So, and I've just heard good things about that. So, you know, there are like another four or five docs I'm going to try and squeeze in on top of the 16.
I got to tell you, I'm a little bit suspicious, a little bit, about the Mitt Romney doc, which I believe is amongst the premieres, because, I'm not looking at the program, but I believe there is a Mitt Romney doc.
Yeah, it's called Mitt. Netflix bought it already.
Okay.
Because I've talked to a couple people that have seen it.
Well, what did they say? Because I'm afraid that it's going to be nice to him, and like that's the unusual thing. Don't do the tip. Anybody can do a hatchet job on Mitt Romney. So the idea would be to find the heart, the soul, the positiveness, the decent guy thing. I'm presuming that's where they go. Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean, what I've been told about it, and the guy that made it spent years on it, and he's the guy who I think he'd done the New York Doll documentary.
Okay.
But anyway, what I'd heard, and don't quote me 100%
Right.
on this, was that he, I don't know if he had a family connection, somehow he had a connection to the Romneys, and very early on, he started filming with them.
Okay.
And apparently he just had incredible access, and he'd made a deal with them that if Romney got elected, that he wouldn't show the documentary until Romney left office.
That's funny.
And the thing I've heard about it, albeit from people at Netflix who bought it, was that, I mean, what they told me off the record was, you know, the last person in the world I went to see a documentary about was Mitt Romney. But when I saw it, I was blown away. Mainly by the access, you know, that it's, you know, there, the camera's there at very intimate moments. And what they say is, yeah, I mean, Romney comes off much less wooden and much more like a person. And,
Okay.
I'm not a Romney fan, and I can't say I'm dying to see the Romney documentary. But, you know, if it's inside, you know, any of those kind of fly on the wall in the middle of a campaign, docs can be interesting.
Sure.
But I don't feel, I mean, from what I sense, it's much more of that kind of verite from inside the bubble, which is interesting, and not so much a hagiography or a,
Okay.
you know, I don't even know if they did real outside interviews with anybody.
Okay. Now, back to your film. There's the one who stands out is Judith Hill, because she, unlike Darlene, unlike Mary Clayton, unlike Lisa Fisher, Tata Vega, is that she's considerably younger than they. And you, I presume, chose her as an example of a younger person. She's what, in her early 30s, mid 30s,
Yeah, I
Judith?
think she's 29 or 30.
Okay. And are there, as we've already noted, the backup singing, at least in studios, is not happening at Ustage. So she's mainly a touring person with some recording, or how does it work with her? What's her career
Yeah,
like
now
these days?
she still does some session work. I mean, session work is few and far between, but she does get calls for sessions. I mean, I know I first met her actually, because I was helping Cameron Crowe do his Elton John, Leon Russell documentary, The Union. And so I was there for a lot of the recording of that album that T-Bone Burnett produced. And Judith sang on that with Tata and Rose Stone and a bunch of other singers.
Okay.
You know, and at the time she was probably 26, 25. And, you know, what I like about her, because I interviewed a number of young singers, but a lot of young singers don't have any sense of the history of backup singing and don't really identify with it and don't really have any story to tell yet. And, you know, Judith grew up in a church in the valley where the choir director was Rose Stone from Sly and the Family Stone. And Tata Vega used to sing with her parents. Her parents played in Billy Preston's band. So she kind of grew up around a lot of these women and knew them. And she had the whole Michael Jackson story, and I just found her incredibly talented. She has a crazy voice. And so for all those reasons, she kind of is the stand-in for, you know, what these singers are dealing with today. And Judith, I think they just announced it, but, you know, she just signed with Sony Records, which is great. And, you know, throughout the whole process of making the film, it was interesting because she was always talking to these older singers, trying to learn from them, you know, what to do and what not to do. And I think she's still trying to figure that out. I mean, it's something you always have to wrestle with. But she's, and the biggest difference for me about Judith is she's a songwriter. And it, you know, she wrote the songs for Spike Lee's Red Hook Summer.
That was nice. And, that was good, that film. I love the gospel singing that they had in that. That was nice.
Yeah. And she wrote like 6 songs for that. And, and I think she's a great songwriter. So I think she has potential. I mean, I think her biggest issue is something that actually all the backup singers deal with, which is they can do anything. You know, they're kind of professional chameleons. And when somebody says to you, okay, do one thing and do it, you know, and that's who you are as an artist, it's really difficult because I know Judith loves funk and soul and all that.
Right.
I think she's a great ballad singer. And so she was on the road with Josh Groban this fall. And like that's one side of Judith, which is totally different from a lot of the other music she does. And I think she's kind of grappling with, you know, who am I supposed to be as an artist?
Right.
Because in the beginning, you're supposed to be one thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, what I got, the second best music high of the year was also at Sundance for me, and that was the Muscle Shoals documentary, which also, that didn't get on the short list like yours, but it was really excellent. Did you have a chance to see that?
I did. I saw it at Sundance. I saw... I must have been the premiere that it was on the second Saturday.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I'd done a documentary about Stax Records years ago, just Memphis soul, and you know, a lot of the Stax artists recorded at Muscle Shoals and vice versa. And I think even some of the Stax people were in the Muscle Shoals doc.
Right.
So I knew that scene and loved it, and I actually knew a bunch of people that worked on that film. Writers and different people who'd worked on it for years. And, you know, I'm a music geek at heart. You know, I have my record collection's way too big, and I love, you know, reading and hearing about producers and songwriters and musicians and drummers and bass players. And, you know, I think, you know, those kinds of stories, I mean, a band like the house band at Muscle Shoals or the house band at Stax, or even these same backup singers. Part of the fun is connecting the dots and saying, you mean those same people did this song and this song and this song and this song? And when you realize that, you know, there's a common, you know, common people, common craft, and just a thread that connects all these disparate songs. It just, I don't, for me, I love making those connections because it deepens my appreciation of them.
When you say you're a music geek and you have many, many records, I presume literally you do mean vinyl records, and you've got a turntable.
Oh, yeah.
And you wouldn't, and you consider it heresy to listen to music on MP3, right?
No, I listen to music every which way. Okay. I'm not like an audiophile as much as just, you know, I collect vinyl because that's how I grew up collecting and appreciating music, and I have at least one of my rooms in my office is completely, the walls are covered in vinyl.
So
that's one of the edit bays. I have theme edit bays in my office, and one is the music edit bay, and it's all vinyl.
Have you, by the way, ever heard of that device that Neil Young was promoting about maybe a year ago, actually, called the Pono?
Yeah.
P-O-N-O?
And that's, yeah, I do remember that.
Do you have any idea what's
going
on with
it? I don't know anybody that had it, no. I don't.
Because the idea was to deliver the dynamic range, which, of course, we don't... How much... What's the percentage of the actual dynamic range of a real sound that a good recording gets? Like, MP3s are delivering, what, 15, 20% of that? Something like that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's crazy how much is cut out of it. And actually, that was one of the things, you know, even for me, you know, when we were doing our temp editing on the documentary, you know, we would download MP3s or we'd rip CDs. And when it came time, you know, once we actually figured out what songs we wanted to use, we went and got the up-res, highest possible quality versions of all the songs. And in a few cases, we even got some 5.1 mixes. And hearing the difference between the MP3 you're used to hearing and then suddenly hearing it properly with an uncompressed file, you know, it's you don't think you're going to notice it as much as you do. And then we did the mix of Skywalker sound, which was incredible. And you go into those rooms, and you know, and it just blows you away. So, you know, I always feel like if you're going to make a music documentary, you've got to really make sure the sound conveys as much as it can. You know, we worked really hard on the sound.
So the I'm very much looking forward to the Rose Bowl thing, which I've been invited to attend.
Oh, great! You're coming. Cool.
Yeah. There's a. There's
I'm going to be there too. My father-in-law's coming, so.
So what's the thing there's a rehearsal and then there's the actual Rose Bowl. Is it the halftime event? Is that what they're doing?
No, I think they're doing the national anthem at the beginning.
Oh, I got it. Okay. So they're not going to do any of their routines. Is how many are, who's singing exactly?
It's Mary, Darlene, Lisa, and Judith.
Oh, wonderful. I can't wait for that.
Yeah. And, I don't know if you're going to be there rehearsal day, but we're going to have a bunch of people over. I actually live just a few blocks from the Rose Bowl.
Okay.
And we're going to have people over and have, like, brunch before rehearsal. So.
Well, that sounds like fun. Okay.
Yeah, it's totally casual.
What time?
You're welcome to come.
Thank you. That'd
I think
be,
that's
that would
at
be
10. I think the rehearsal's at noon on the 31st, and they're going to come around 10, 10:30, just for an hour, and just have some bagels and eggs and have a chance to see each other.
All right. And where is the actual rehearsal is going to take place at the Rose Bowl
itself?
At
the Rose Bowl.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Well, that sounds lovely. Thank you very much for the invite.
I'll figure out the details and I can send them to you.
Okay. All right, man. Well, it was awfully nice speaking to you. And again, my profuse apologies for being
don't worry about it.
Caught up in the holiday stuff. It was really pretty I don't know, just like it was conspiratorial. It's just I kept getting blocked by this or that. So
I know how it goes. Are you? Do you live in New York or LA?
No, I'm a West Hollywood person. I'm just here because my mom lives in an assisted living facility in Connecticut. My kids live here. My two sons, who are 25 and 24.
Okay. Well, I'll see you back in California.
Thank you, man. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. No problem. Take care.
See you well. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.